This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll look at a case in Rhode Island that bans traditional father-daughter and mother-son activities. The Rhode Island ACLU calls it gender stereotyping that only perpetuates outdated notions of girl and boy activities. We'll take a look at a lawsuit in Wisconsin alleging that the Federal Highway Administration's Office of Civil Rights is allegedly discriminating against minorities.
For generations, African Americans and others have been locked into cities while whites flee to the suburbs on huge highways. And what happens to public transportation? It's pushed into the ground.
We'll talk with author Lance Selfa about his recent book, The Democrats, A Critical History. His hard-hitting assessment of the Democratic Party is essential reading for any activist who wants to understand how to win change in this country, and anyone who thinks we need an alternative to the two-party state. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Last week, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund filed a federal lawsuit challenging the New York Police Department's use of sidewalk arrests, in which persons are targeted for false arrest because of their association with or proximity to dissent or protest. This lawsuit was filed on behalf of several individuals falsely arrested in late September 2001, the first week of the Occupy Wall Street movement, including one plaintiff who was subjected to Deputy Inspector Anthony Bologna's notorious pepper spray attack on peaceful demonstrators. The lawsuit seeks to end the police tactics of arresting persons present on city sidewalks and the use of orange police netting to conduct indiscriminate group arrests. It also seeks compensatory and punitive damages against New York Police Department officers for the false arrests and against Deputy Inspector Bologna for the pepper spray assault. Legal director of the partnership, Carl Massinio, said, quote, "It is evident from the mass use of illegal sidewalk arrests executed yet again this weekend during Occupy Wall Street demonstrations that this is an unlawful tactic the NYPD will use over and over again until a judge declares it to be unconstitutional." He ended, "With this lawsuit, protesters are taking the offensive to stop it." As we've seen for years in New York City, starting with the 2004 Republican National Convention, the mayor, the police department engage in a range of unconstitutional actions that send a threatening message to people wanting to take to the streets in political protest, that free speech activities are viewed as criminal activities. Those who participate run the risk of police violence and false arrest. We see that people time and time again are motivated by the urgency of the underlying social message rather than being dissuaded by the fear-mongering tactics of the police department. Recently, the Insane Clown Posse, the Detroit-based horrorcore rapping duo, who've actually built a multi-million dollar platinum career, have announced their intention to sue the FBI for labeling their fans, quote, "a loosely organized hybrid gang." Last October, the FBI's annual National Gang Threat Assessment Report called ICP's terrifically loyal fan base, known for painting their faces like angry harlequins, quote, "a criminal organization formed on the street, on a par with the Latin Kings and the Aryan Brotherhood." The FBI reported that Juggalos have not only infiltrated the U.S. Army and the Air Force, but they also use social networking, quote, "to communicate and expand." Before last fall, the Juggalos had been regarded as a criminal enterprise in four states, California, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Utah. But the FBI's assessment has more widespread repercussions. Earlier this year, for example, one Juggalo from Albuquerque ended up on New Mexico's most wanted list after skipping probation, explicitly because of his ties to the Insane Clown Posse Juggalo Gang, as the FBI wrote. And at this year's 13th annual gathering of the Juggalos, the Department of Homeland Security actually showed up. On August 24th, ICP's legal team filed a Freedom of Information Act request demanding that the FBI release whatever information led to the organization being labeled a gang. There's been no response to date, so the band's representatives filed suit against the FBI and the U.S. District Court in the Eastern District of Michigan for failing to produce any documentary evidence. Meanwhile, last month, ICP's label launched a website, JuggalosFightBack.com, so that fans could submit stories about how they've been unfairly treated by law enforcement. Evidently, they're still sorting through thousands of responses, trying to look for the best cases, and the plan is for additional suits to be filed in the future. Howard Hertz, their Michigan-based legal counsel, characterized the whole situation thus: "This whole thing is absurd," he said. Last week, the Houston office of the Texas Civil Rights Project called for a full and open investigation into the Houston Police Department killing of Brian Clounch, a one-armed, one-legged man in a wheelchair. The group is asking for more than an internal police investigation, but also a separate, independent, and very public investigation to be conducted by the district attorney. According to reports, Houston police officer Matt Marin shot Mr. Clounch in the head after he approached the officer's partner in his wheelchair while waving a black felt pen. The police department said that Marin feared for the safety of his partner and the safety of himself, discharged his duty weapon, and struck the subject. Police records indicate that this very same officer shot and killed another man in a similar incident just 3 years ago. This case is important because cities across the country increasingly are facing the need for greater accountability among police forces when they decide especially to use deadly force, and in many cases when the victim is disabled. Last week in Harlem, for example, police shot a young man who had a disability. And it's likely that many of these tragic shootings would not have occurred had police officers involved been properly trained to deal with human beings with special needs. In Rhode Island, the Cranston School Department recently announced that it is banning traditional father-daughter and mother-son activities, citing a violation of state law. The controversy arose when a local parent-teacher organization, with support from the school, organized a father-daughter dance for female students and a mother-son outing to a Pawtucket Red Sox baseball game. When a single mother complained that her daughter could not attend the dance because her father wasn't a part of her life, the ACLU notified the school district that they were suing for gender discrimination under Rhode Island law. The Rhode Island ACLU posted a statement noting that, quote, "This type of gender stereotyping only perpetuates outdated notions of girl and boy activities and is contrary to federal law." To talk more about the case, we're joined today by Stephen Brown, Executive Director of the Rhode Island American Civil Liberties Union. To talk more about this case, we're joined today by Stephen Brown, Executive Director of the Rhode Island Civil Liberties Union. Welcome, Stephen, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Well, we have another interesting case related to gender parity. We'll get into the facts of the case, but I wanted to first start by letting our listeners know a little bit about Title IX. What is it? What does it protect?
Sure. Title IX is a federal law. It's really been one of the most crucial laws to promote fairness and equality on the basis of gender in the school setting in particular, in this context. It is the law that has ensured that school athletics, particularly in the college level, are open to women. It has been a real driving force, in that respect at least, in opening up opportunities that girls from lowest school levels to the college level were really kept out of for decades until this law was passed.
And I understand that the law provides certain exceptions for things such as so-called mother-daughter, father-son activities, which I suppose have been traditional around the country, more so in some parts than others. Can you explain that exception, and how far does that reach? What does the ACLU think of that?
Sure. Title IX, when it was enacted in the 1970s, was a very strong law. It remains a very strong law. there are certain exemptions. One in particular says that it's okay for schools to have father-son and mother-daughter events without violating this general ban on sex discrimination in school activities if those gender-exclusive events are reasonably comparable to each other. So under this particular exemption, it's okay to have a father-son activity and a mother-daughter activity to segregate in that way if the events are reasonably comparable.
I understand that in Rhode Island, that exemption is not honored. What does that mean?
Well, back in the 1980s, I believe, Rhode Island passed its own version of Title IX, a state law that was designed to ensure that there would be non-discrimination on the basis of sex in Rhode Island's own schools. It just set a state standard, a state remedy, generally on par with the federal law. But the Rhode Island law was much shorter. It's a much shorter statute and doesn't go into all the details that the federal law does. And it also does not explicitly include an exemption for these types of father-daughter, mother-son activities.
That, I assume, could be read to mean that, in fact, Rhode Island affords greater protections by not having that exemption.
That would be our interpretation of the law, yes. There's never been any formal or judicial interpretation of our state law and what it means, whether and how it's different from the standards of Title IX. But we would argue that it is, in some respects, broader, more protective than Title IX is.
Now, let's go back to the sort of story narrative at hand. And as I understand it, there's been a bit of public furor, which we'll get into in a few minutes, but actually a policy change, as I understand it, was made several months ago, but just was receiving public attention this past September. And this involves a particular school where a mother challenged the father-daughter dance. Is that right?
Well, actually, the policy change goes back a few years. And that's one of the very interesting things about the way this has played out. What happened was that in April or May of this year, we did receive a complaint from a parent, a single mother, who has a daughter attending a school in the Cranston School District. And she received a notice of what was called a Me and My Guy dinner dance for girls attending the school. And it invited the girls to bring a guy of their choice to this dance. The mother, she's a single mom. There is no adult male in her life at this point. She's raised her daughter by herself. So when she got this notice, she was concerned that she wouldn't be able to attend. She was also concerned that the boys' event was for a baseball outing to a minor league baseball game, and that was for mothers and their sons, so she was barred from that event as well. So she contacted various school officials, she contacted the PTO, and expressed concerns about the discriminatory nature of these events, and initially they said, well, that's what we're doing. She pointed out that the dances that had been conducted by the PTO in the past few years had been gender neutral. They'd been family dances, and so the PTO was actually reverting to a very old type of tradition that they'd actually stopped a few years previously. Nonetheless, the PTO said, we've decided we want to bring back this father-daughter dance, and that's what we're doing. And it was at that point that the mother contacted us. We agreed with her concerns that it didn't seem appropriate for a school event to be exclusive in this way, to prevent this mother from attending either event. And, of course, we were also very concerned about the stereotypical nature of the activities, that the girls were being channeled into a dance while the boys were being channeled to a baseball game. And we thought that just, you know, in 2012, it just wasn't appropriate to be having those types of gender stereotypes promoted by a school district.
Now, in addition to the stereotypes you just mentioned, it also raises the issue of, well, it has to be opposite genders going to a dance or a baseball game. It can't be two women, for example, going to the dance.
That's right. I mean, these were, the dance itself was specifically publicized as a me and my guy dinner dance. Bring the adult male of your choice. So you're absolutely right. It was exclusive in a few ways. You know, that's the way it was advertised, and that's the way initially they said they were going to do it. So we did write this letter to the school superintendent and raise concerns both about the gender-exclusive nature of the event, the discriminatory, stereotypical nature of these events, and we very quickly got a letter back from the superintendent, not only saying that they agreed with us, that it was inappropriate, but what the superintendent said was they had actually notified PTOs a few years previously that they should not be holding these types of events. And instead, it was sort of a rogue PTO president deciding to bring back this father-daughter dance after it had disappeared for some time. So we thought that the problem was all resolved. You know, the response was a very good one. It not only agreed with us, as I said, but it noted that they had agreed with us before we even wrote this letter. So we thought that was the end of it, and it was the end of it until a week or two ago when a candidate for state office in Cranston decided to turn it into a political issue. And that's where we are now.
What kind of response has the general public been giving to this issue?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it's always hard to determine who is the general public. I mean, you have people who call into the radio talk shows. I'm not sure they actually represent the general public. They represent a very vocal minority of the general public. If you only listen to radio talk shows, you'd think that this was the worst thing that had happened in decades, and the world was falling down if we made these events gender neutral. On the other hand, you know, in Cranston itself, there's been recognition that this is really a political issue, not a school issue. A number of people who attended and spoke at the school committee meeting the other day all pointed out that the Republican Party, was a Republican candidate who had raised this issue in his campaign, and the Republican Party sent out notices about it. So it had turned into a partisan issue as opposed to, you know, what's appropriate as a matter of educational policy. So there's been a lot of positions being taken on both sides. I won't deny there's a lot of how dare anybody fool with this long-standing tradition, even though it really isn't a long-standing tradition. But there are others who've also supported the ACLU's position and say, you know, why are you making a big deal out of this? Why can't you just have family events that everybody can go to and nobody feels isolated?
Exactly. I was wondering how popular the full family events that you referenced earlier went at the school.
They were fine. Everybody, there were no objections when these family events had been held. Lots of people attended them. You had, a cross-section, girls, boys, mothers, dads, going, and it was fine. You know, this really is an issue generated out of nothing, and that's unfortunate.
I want to ask you about the issue of classes that are segregated by gender. I know the ACLU has also taken this up in some jurisdictions around the country. What's the situation in this same school district?
Yeah, in Rhode Island, there have been no efforts to have segregated classes by gender. So that is not an issue that's cropped up at all here. Instead, it has come up as through this PTO extracurricular activity type event. But so far, we've not had to deal with even what is even a more serious issue of actually having girls and boys go to different classes.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of this particular issue around the country? I'm sure there are other schools that have father-daughter, mother-son type events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, obviously I'm no expert on what school districts across the country are doing, but from what I've been reading and hearing about as a result of the controversy that's been generated by this issue here in Rhode Island, it seems that, yes, there are other school districts across the country that have similar events, but also, as in Rhode Island, it's something that has been disappearing. More and more school districts have changed what used to be these traditional gender-exclusive events into more open family events. So there clearly is a trend over the years and over the past decade or so to get rid of these types of gender-segregated events in favor of a more inclusive type.
Let me just go back quickly to the particular mother and daughter involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
I assume their identity is not public.
That's correct.
But do you know if either has suffered any kind of ostracism as a result?
At this point, I don't believe so, and that's because their identities have remained confidential. If the name was out there, I would expect, based not only on some of the vitriol we've seen here, but also vitriol we experienced in another case, totally unrelated case we had with the same school district, that there probably would be some adverse consequences to the family.
You remind me that we usually like to touch at the end of our segments on related activism on a particular cause. Now, have there been students who have sort of taken up any of these issues, and are we talking about an apolitical academic environment there?
On this particular issue?
Right.
I'm not sure the students themselves care as much as some of the parents do.
Right.
I haven't heard or seen any tremendous uproar from the student body itself about all this. You know, I think they're cool with it all. Now, one of the things that the PTO at an elementary school said was the kids at the elementary school supported, the boys said they wanted a boys' event, and the girls said they wanted a girls' event. And, you know, that's fine, but it seems to me that the parents and the administrators at the school should be doing more than just saying, well, these elementary school kids would like to have different events, so let's promote that. You know, when it comes to discriminatory issues, you know, whether events should be segregated by gender, by race, or anything else, this is something for the parents and the adults to say, we have to do it a certain way.
Steve, we have to go, but this is a fascinating case. We wish you the best of luck and hope to have you back on to discuss the positive outcome.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoy it.
The Federal Highway Administration's Office of Civil Rights is moving to hold Wisconsin transportation officials accountable for alleged discrimination against minorities. Although the state says it's in compliance, a lawsuit is proceeding on the legal basis of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits agencies that receive federal funds from discriminating on the basis of race, color, and national origin. The lawsuit could freeze construction on a major Wisconsin freeway interchange. Meanwhile, the ACLU of Wisconsin and the Black Health Coalition of Wisconsin continue to issue complaints that state's Department of Transportation has failed to address their requirements to gather data about the impact their actions are having on minority communities. We're joined today by Karen Rotker, Senior Staff Attorney for the ACLU of Wisconsin. Welcome, Karen, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Michael and I were talking about the fact that we don't really know that much about Federal Highway Administrations and the fact that they even have offices of civil rights. Can you give us kind of an overview of what's at stake here and how the Highway Administration operates?
Sure. So Title VI of the Civil Rights Act applies to any entity, including agencies, that receive federal funding. And it means if you get federal money, you can't discriminate on the basis of race. Most, if not all, federal agencies have civil rights offices or units or divisions that enforce those Title VI requirements. One of the really important things about the Title VI regulations is that it doesn't just prohibit intentional discrimination, but it prohibits actions that have a discriminatory effect. And those are enforced by these various civil rights agencies. So Federal Highway Administration, which is part of the U.S. Department of Transportation, has its civil rights division. The Federal Transit Administration has a civil rights division. other federal agencies like Department of Education or has a civil rights office as well. And so they're the ones in charge of making sure that their recipients actually comply with civil rights law. Unfortunately, historically, that compliance has often been, you know, largely ignored. And so we were actually pleased that the civil rights folks at FHWA were willing to look into this issue.
Okay, so let me just backtrack for listeners who don't know. This means that they are barred from discriminating on the basis of race, color, national origin, gender, age, or disability.
Well, Title VI actually itself only applies to race, color, and national origin. There are other laws that apply in most but not always identical degrees about disability and gender. But
like Title the ADA.
Like the ADA and like Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And then there are certain other rules that apply to gender. It's not always exactly the same, although particularly disability tends to be very similar. But Title VI is race-specific, and that was part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Okay, so let's fast forward to recent years. What has been happening with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation?
I want to step back for a second, if I may, because I think it's something else your listeners probably don't realize, is we're working in an environment where metropolitan Milwaukee and the counties around it, is the most racially segregated region in the United States. Number one, it is worse than any other region. A big part of the issue is that you've also got job growth in these overwhelmingly white suburbs and absolutely no transit access. And at the same time, you have persons of color in Milwaukee and in the region, but almost all of them live in Milwaukee, who are much, much more likely to be dependent on transit than white persons in the community. Overlaid on that is you have road project after road project, billions of dollars going into highway. They call it reconstruction. A lot of it is massive rebuilding, expansion, and so on. So it's developing a transportation system that benefits commuters who are disproportionately white. And is, at the same time, the transit system is biting the dust. And there's essentially no support for that. So you're building sort of a dual transit system, transportation system, a highway system that benefits white commuters, and a transit system that people of color depend on that is being ground into the dust and doesn't provide job access. We see that from the sort of statewide Department of Transportation perspective as a method of administering their program that is clearly having a discriminatory effect on people of color. And we've been working on different ways of challenging this for years.
Let me ask a question about that and then go back to Milwaukee. I want to broaden it a little bit because obviously in New York, where we're broadcasting from, we had Robert Moses building roads everywhere, supposedly, or at least according to Robert Caro's biographer, making the bridges going out to Long Island too low to get buses through. Therefore, you were going to, at that point, make Long Island more white than African-American. And throughout the country, what you're talking about in Milwaukee, even though it's the most segregated of the major cities, it seems like some of that's going on throughout the country or is going on. Can you just give us some perspective and then let's go back to Milwaukee?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that it's likely going on in lots of parts of the country. I mean, Milwaukee's the region I know because I live here and I read the data all the time. Now, in some parts of the country where there are multiple forms of public transportation, you've got the California cases about rail versus bus service, where rail is serving certain demographic of commuters and bus service is serving urban people of color, and they're not being treated fairly. I don't know if that's true in New York. That could be as well. I think there are a lot of communities where the road systems are being built in ways that benefit certain communities, tend to benefit whiter and more upper income communities, and the transportation system, especially bus systems in a lot of places, persons of color are more dependent on that and in a lot of cases are being starved. I think it's a fact-specific, you know, you kind of got to look at your region, look at how the transportation system is operating. But I think there are hooks that you can look at to try to challenge this.
Now, let's talk about the challenge back to Wisconsin. Apparently, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation has not had a Title VI plan for years.
there's a whole slew, in addition to federal regulations saying that you can't discriminate on the basis of race, you can't have a discriminatory effect on the basis of race. There's actually a list of 8 or 10 requirements that state departments of transportation have to comply with. One of them says you have to have, it's called a Title VI implementing plan, and you have to update it annually. So this is supposed to be, you know, you evaluate Title VI, you think about your civil rights compliance, you think about how you're going to put it in practice, and every year you go and update it. I actually wasn't aware of those regulations until 2011, and when I saw them, I did an open records request to the Wisconsin Department of Transportation and said, I'd like to see your Title VI plan. And they emailed me back saying, we haven't had one since 2004.
And they're supposed to have one every year.
They're supposed to have one every year. And the really, the other egregious part of it was the Federal Highway Administration, although the main offices are in D.C., they have these division offices all around the country. In a lot of cases, those division offices are very cozy with the state departments of transportation. And they really also are mostly worried about building roads and don't really understand or think about or effectuate civil rights. And it appears that the division office in Wisconsin knew that the State Department of Transportation didn't have a Title VI plan and let them ignore that requirement
now,
for years.
Karen, what brought this to your attention? Is there a specific issue that people are complaining about?
The other issue that's going on here is there is a specific highway project that is on the table that they're going to try and build in the next few years. It's a $1.6 or $1.8 billion reconstruction of an interchange in the city of Milwaukee, where they've explicitly refused to incorporate transit as part of their assessment, environmental impact analysis, and so on. We were in the process of preparing comments objecting to that decision, and I was reading through the federal rules to try to figure out, you know, if there were additional aspects that we ought to be bringing up in our comments. And that was when I came across the requirement for a Title VI implementing plan.
Mm-hmm.
So it is related, although separate issue, is that actually last month we also filed a federal lawsuit against the expansion of this interchange project, which we think is going to facilitate commuting for, again, white suburban commuters in a project where they have expressly refused to include transit. But it
yes,
was,
you know, that's what really interests me, because they're building this huge project, and you've decided that both between a lawsuit and the Title VI requirements that you want to do something about it in terms of public transportation. Can you just talk about that a little more?
We have advocated, lobbied, commented, been to meetings for years. And unfortunately, and this is, you know, also unfortunately a nonpartisan issue. I mean, it's both political parties who, in a lot of ways, over the past decade, who have let transit bite the dust. Again, transit that people of color need to access, jobs, medical care, schools, and everything else, and who have pumped billions and billions of dollars into road rebuilding and expansion projects that don't serve lots of our inner city communities and persons who really depend on job access. As I said, the cases in California where you have two different modes of transportation, so you've got rail and buses, you know, and you're struggling between those two, raises different legal issues. This is taking a step back in an environmental justice way and looking at transportation systems as a whole and the spending on transportation systems. And we think that when you have data, as they have here, that something like maybe close to half of African Americans and Latinos in Milwaukee don't have either lack licenses or cars or both. If you're spending all your transportation system money on one mode, which is highways, and ignoring the needs of transit for people of color, that is a method of running a program that has a discriminatory effect. And in the lawsuit, we're trying to incorporate some of these Title VI civil rights compliance issues into the framework of federal law. Says when you're doing an analysis of a project, you have to look at indirect effects, cumulative effects. You have to certify Title VI compliance. And we don't think they did it.
Karen, Let's humanize this a bit more. You started to paint the picture. We're looking at communities, say, of African Americans who are increasingly being denied public transportation, so it affects how they get to work, how they get medical access. Give us one or two quick stories of people who have been impacted by this. And
so, let me give you an example. We were at a hearing a couple months ago, and a member of an inner city church came and talked about a young man who had been employed while he was sort of in transitioning out of a prison system and was in a halfway house where there was transportation provided by that facility to a job in one of the neighboring suburbs. But when he was released and just released back into the community, he lost that job because the bus line stopped 3 miles from where the job was. And it would have, and this is Wisconsin, it gets cold here, there's bad weather, and it would have required taking hours to get to work, and then it would have required essentially walking the last 3 miles to his job. That's an example of it. There are examples of job growth in suburban communities where they have explicitly refused to put bus lines or transit access. So you have joblessness, not just formal unemployment, but black male joblessness in Milwaukee is over 50%. And people physically cannot get to work. Or if you're transit dependent, even if you work somewhere that's on a transit line, hours of service are being cut. If you work late at night, you might not be able to get a bus. If you have to make a connection early in the morning or late at night, it can take you hours to get from one part of Milwaukee County to another, and there's less and less ability to access jobs in different parts of the county, and if you need to go out of the county, you're sunk.
If listeners are interested in this topic, can you direct us to a website?
There's a fair amount of information posted on our website, aclu-wi.org. If you scroll down into our blog, which is called Forward for Liberty, we post articles about that. If people have specific questions about this issue as well, they can email liberty@aclu-wi.org.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Thank you, Karen. I find this fascinating
and a subject that does not receive the kind of attention it deserves.
Well, I appreciate you reaching out, and it was great to talk to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. As the 2012 presidential election draws near, many are complacent about what they see as having to choose between the lesser of two evils. By electing political heads of the left-right political paradigm, where third-party candidates are marginalized, sidelined, or altogether pushed out, what are we really supporting? Today, we talk with author Lance Selfa, whose book, The Democrats, A Critical History, offers a realistic assessment of the Democratic Party and examines the nature of the party beyond the campaign rhetoric and media hype. Lance joins us today to talk about his book, The Democratic Party, and the upcoming election. Welcome, Lance, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the reforms that people had hoped for and really expected under the Obama administration have not materialized. And it seems that Obama is likely to be reelected, according to some of the polls. So we wanted to start by taking a critical look at the Democratic Party and ask you, how would you generally describe it?
Well, I would describe it as one of the two big business parties that runs the American political system, that trades office between itself and the Republican Party. Therefore, it really is an instrument in the hands largely of big business through its funding, through its provision of think tank resources, through even its staffing of different both political and sort of government offices. Though I think many people don't perceive it that way, because it has this sort of image of being the party of the people. It's the party that most African Americans vote for, that union members vote for, and so on. Really, what actually controls it behind the scenes is, or actually not so often behind the scenes, is actually big business interests.
And how long has it been that way?
Well, you could argue it's been that way ever since big business, I guess, has been around. But if you look at the history of the party, without going into a whole lot of detail, it was the party that really represented and tied together the Southern slaveholding class from the South with some Northern financial interests and some Western farming interests. That was all the way back, even in the Civil War, pre-Civil War era. Though it has been the party that has traditionally been the one that sort of has brought what you might call out groups, or groups that are formerly despised or looked down upon, into the sort of mainstream political process over time. It has never lost the fact that it ultimately answers to big business interests.
You write that the Democratic Party has been the graveyard of social reform, going back to the populist and progressive movements of 100 years ago, and even before that to Reconstruction after the Civil War, up to the dismantling of the radical labor movement of the 30s and the activist movements of the 60s. Why do you write that?
Well, because I think the historical record upholds that I think that, and if I could sort of call on the memory of Howard Zinn, as the radical historian who really put in the center of American history the idea that it's actually social movements and ordinary people fighting oftentimes against the political and business establishment that has actually brought about just about all the most positive social reform that we think of, the right to form unions, the right to vote, dismantling of segregation in the South, and so on. All of those things really come about because of pressure from below and social movements. Most of the record of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, for that matter, is really not leading on any of those issues. Maybe perhaps they could co-opt some of the movements that arise up, oftentimes in opposition to political leaders that actually don't want to act on all those issues. But once they start to see the things, that the winds are shifting, politicians can reposition themselves. But generally, once they do that, and social movements often look at, and a lot of times social movement leaders, after they've been sort of fighting in the vineyards for years and years, they actually look at the possibility of having some sort of mainstream influence in the system, and politicians are there to sort of say, hey, come along with us, you know, you vote for us and we'll actually represent your interests, that you actually see a transformation of some of the organizations themselves, in which they become more along the lines of electoral machines and actually lose their sort of connection to the base that actually put them in the position to have any kind of influence. So I think that's kind of the way that I tried to explain it in the book.
How do you explain that the Democratic Party, which brought in Social Security, unemployment insurance, Medicare, Medicaid in the 60s, is the very same party that also brought in the CIA, the Vietnam War, the national security state?
Well, I mean, that's the crucial thing that I try to kind of get across in the book, that at least in the era of the 30s up to the present, and especially as the time after the Second World War, when the United States became the main sort of leading power in the world, that the Democratic Party, in particular, being the leader of the U.S., really for the most part, political leader of the U.S. from the 30s through the 40s, and then for a large part, really, of the post-war era, that it always happened to combine, in the kind of, I don't know if you want to say the model of the way that it operated, but it combined this sense in which the party was looked on, and the Democrats were looked on as the party of Social Security and Medicare and so on, but that was always coupled with a commitment on the part of the Democratic Party to an aggressive foreign policy, that actually got us into wars like Vietnam. I think if you look at the history of the Democratic Party administrations throughout much of the 20th century, they're the main ones that lead the U.S. into war, even if Republicans often end up being the ones that carry out the wars later. But there's a real bipartisan commitment to that U.S. empire, and that at least up until in the post-war era, when the economy was growing, when the United States was the leading power of the world, when capitalism had its biggest boom in its history, you could sort of combine those two things, or at least the government thought it could combine those two things, guns and butter. And yet the Vietnam War really showed that that was not possible, and that led to one of the main economic crises of the mid-70s. And I think since then, the kind of neoliberal era that came about out of that, you have a situation in which both major parties are actually more interested in the guns part and less interested in the butter part.
Kevin Phillips, Ronald Reagan's speechwriter, called the Democratic Party history's second most enthusiastic capitalist party. And you emphasize this description in your book. Why is that?
Well, as I was starting to say earlier, that if you look at, I think that both the Democrats and the Republicans are the two major political parties that run the mainstream political system. Both of them answer to big business interests. I try to argue that you can't necessarily say that certain kinds of businesses support Republicans and certain kinds of businesses support Democrats. There is a little bit of evidence to say, you know, Hollywood gives more of its money to the Democrats and, say, farm interests give more of their money to the Republicans. But those alliances are never permanently and fixed. Just the fact that Wall Street money has shifted so dramatically from really funding a large part of Obama's campaign in 2008 to now basically flipping over and supporting Romney overall shows that business tries to get play both parties to make sure that its interests are always preserved. And so when that Kevin Phillips quote sort of, I think, underscores kind of another theme of the book, that the Democrats, with maybe that exception of the post-war period, are kind of like the Plan B party for capital. Capital would prefer to have a party that really, and as the Republicans have sort of developed to be, just purely a party of big business that doesn't even make an attempt to say that it's in favor of any kind of programs for the poor or so on. The Democrats at least have those rhetorical commitments and have a certain social base that they have to placate at least enough so that they'll continue to vote for them. But business finds out that in periods such as, say, the end of the Bush administration, the most unpopular administration probably since Richard Nixon's, that Republicans were going to be turfed out of office anyway, so they start to move their money, the business starts to move its money over to Democrats to make sure that whoever the Democrats put in power from at all different levels of the administration are people that are going to owe a lot of their allegiance to business, and we'll end up, I think I have a quote in the book, that this was actually earlier on in the campaign when it looked as if in 2008 that Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee, that quote from some business, I think it was a defense industry lobbyist that was in the Wall Street Journal or something, who said, oh yeah, by the way, we're already talking to Hillary's people, we're getting everything lined up for the new administration so that they'll pay attention to us.
With the election coming up in just weeks, do you view supporting the Democratic Party as a distraction from the process of effecting real change in this country?
I would say, I don't know if distraction is the right word, but I think that it actually operates in cross purposes. Now, I know that a lot of people that are rank and file activists, day in, day out fighters for the poor, for working people, for the rights of African Americans and women and so on, I realize that most of those people are probably going to go to the polls and vote for Obama because they see, and pretty accurately, that the other side doesn't really have anything to offer for them and would actually make things a lot worse. With that understanding, however, I think that the experience of the last 4 years should actually indicate to people that really thought that Obama was going to bring forth a whole number of reforms to show that the way that really those things would come about is only really through the struggle from below. And in fact, just at the most, one thing you could, I guess, argue, probably one of the only sort of progressive reforms that you could even say that Obama has brought about on some of the issues related to LGBT equality. And I think that that's an example in which you actually had a movement that continued, whether or not people voted for Obama or had hopes in him, but a movement that actually continued to put pressure on the administration and with civil disobedience, with demonstrations from the big October demonstration, October 20, 2009, I think it was, for marriage equality, the organization of some of the military veterans that were coming out to talk about speaking out against Don't Ask, Don't Tell. When Obama finally gets dragged kicking and screaming to declare that he's, and the Democratic Party put in their platform, that they're in favor of marriage equality, it's only because of the activism of people from below. You know, you're not long ago, Democrats were running scared from the idea of even being associated with anything to do with LGBT equality. I think likewise, Obama has thrown out a gesture, an important one, but pretty small potatoes when you think about the overall issue that's involved around the issue of immigration, around allowing an extra 2 years for people who are children of undocumented immigrants to appeal for work permits. Again, a small gesture given the real demands that people have around the DREAM Act and legalization. But that also came about because there were people who came out of the shadows and demanded and actually stayed some sit-ins in Obama campaign headquarters to say, you know, pay attention to this issue. And Obama realized that he also needed to have much more of a vote from the Latino votes and so on to actually have a shot at winning this election.
At the recent Democratic National Convention protests and also at the RNC in Tampa, local municipalities spent millions and millions of dollars on security and really hyped up the fact that they anticipated thousands of protesters coming to town, and yet there were very few protesters. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of different explanations for that. Something similar happened here in Chicago back in May when there was a lot of hype around the NATO meetings, and the demonstrations actually turned out to be fairly good size, probably not as much as organizers had anticipated earlier, but it was necessary to really come out and not be cowed by a lot of that media and security hype. Other than that, I think that they're often very successful in dampening down protests because of all of that hype. And I think that there's a number of different reasons. It could be that some of those areas were not as accessible to large numbers of people to travel to Tampa and to Charlotte. The other possibility, too, could be just that where people see change coming from, that the conventions themselves are not necessarily thought of that way, that there are actually other many more important local struggles that people are involved with. And a couple weeks ago, the Chicago teacher strike had a lot more impact in terms of issues related to labor and education reform than, you know, necessarily a demonstration in some kind of a free speech pen with security aligning all around you in a place like Charlotte or Tampa.
Lance, we just have a few minutes, but I wanted to end by mentioning that you write in your book about Hitler coming to power because the liberals in Germany in 1932 essentially voted for the lesser of two evil candidates.
Right.
Von Hindenburg, who then appointed Hitler as chancellor. Hitler then staged the Reichstag fire, blamed it on the communists, took power. He made all the laws, replaced the parliament. What lessons for the United States would you draw from that history?
Okay, well, I shouldn't claim credit for that analogy. That's from a really important article that I think is worth reading for everyone. It's actually printed in the back of the book. It's an article from a 60s activist, Hal Draper, who was active in the free speech movement, as an old socialist as well. And he was making the argument about the lesser evil at that time. It was called Who Will Be the Lesser Evil in 68. But I think that the general argument that he puts out there, and that's the most extreme case that he argues, the Hitler-Hindenburg thing, is that if one succumbs to the idea that there are only two choices and the only thing that anybody can do politically is to choose the less bad one, you know, the lesser of the two evils, then he says that actually the problem is that leaving the choice at just that is what the problem is of this kind of conundrum. It's not that there isn't a lesser evil. In this election, I think you could make a very good case that Obama is the lesser evil to Romney. Again, when you talk about, you line their programs and what they say they're going to do up against each other. And yet, does voting for Obama will vote for voting for Obama actually advance an agenda of social movements? I would argue no, and that's kind of what Draper was getting at in that analogy. If you actually believe that voting for the lesser evil is all you can do, then you're actually in a situation where you're not actually able to advance the struggle that's necessary to actually fight for what you really want. I think that's one important point. The other, there's another several other lessons from that article, and of course, that analogy about Hitler and Hindenburg obviously doesn't translate exactly, you know, in the current situation today. But I think that the important sort of lessons that come from that is that there are times in which even when the lesser evil is apparent, that the lesser evil being in power can also be the one that actually carries out some of the greater evil's policies. One of the things that Draper was talking about at that time was the comparison between Lyndon Johnson and Goldwater in 64, where Goldwater was the warmonger who plunged us into war, Johnson was the peace candidate. Well, what happens? The left votes for the lesser evil, Johnson, the peace candidate, who then plunges the country into the Vietnam War. I think a similar dynamic is going on today. If Obama wins today, I think it will be because he will become a champion of Medicare and Social Security against Ryan and Romney, who want to tear them both up. And yet we know for certain that what Obama wants to do in his second term is so-called entitlement reform, which translates into cutting Medicare and Social Security. So I don't think the left should be in the situation saying, well, it's better that we put Obama in charge of cutting entitlements instead of Romney. The left should be about fighting the cuts to entitlements, no matter who's putting them across.
Well said. And the book for listeners is The Democrats, A Critical History. Lance Selfa, thank you so much for joining us. A really important addition for people who are interested in the state of our country and the two parties.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.